I'm Jeff Sickinga, Executive Director of the Ashbrook Center, and this is The American Idea, where we discuss the ideas, people, and events that have made America what it is today. We believe that by understanding our history and our principles, we can better live up to the promise of the American founding and preserve our ongoing experiment in self-government. Welcome to The American Idea. I want to welcome everyone to this episode of The American Idea. Today we're going to be talking about an issue that's probably not on the top of people's list of events, current things in the news, but boy, is it important. It's one of these lurking underlying issues that is critical to America's national security, critical to our foreign policy, and that is the question of military recruiting and readiness, and particularly the crisis in American military recruiting and readiness. And for that conversation, I'm joined today by Will Tebow. Will is an Army Ranger veteran, having served in the United States military. He is currently the director of the American Military Project at the Claremont Institute, and the author of a recent publication called Identity in the Trenches. So we have with us someone who has been on the front lines, military service, and is now thinking deeply and seriously about the issues facing our military. Will Tebow, thanks for joining us on The American Idea.
Thanks for having me, Jeff.
Well, let's start with just the numbers to help our listeners understand what you call the crisis. Where are we in military recruiting and readiness by the facts and by the figures?
To start, the military has the lowest end strength since the Vietnam War, the end strength being the number of active duty service members who are ready to serve and defend American national interests on any given day. It's below 425,000 in the Army, for example. And for the first time in 3 years, the Army, Navy, and Air Force met their recruiting goals this past year only because all three of those services reduced their goals by over 10% in order to react to the fact that we were in a generational, intractable recruiting crisis that had manifested itself in the previous 2 years. We know from Army internal data that the share of white recruits is the lowest it's ever been and has been declining for 7 consecutive years. But that has come at a time when more diverse populations have not joined at an increased rate, meaning we have this deficit of end strength that is directly affecting the United States military's ability to respond to multiple threats throughout the world, even though the military still maintains a strategic posture to fight 2 big wars and 1 small war at one time.
So this is folks who have been paying attention to this issue over a long time. Sometimes we'll go all the way back to an author like Alexis de Tocqueville, who talks about the difficulty of democracies fighting wars, which is democracies are often very preoccupied with living their private lives, pursuing their life, liberty, and happiness, engaging in commerce, not necessarily warlike nations who are looking outward, preparing to fight. And Tocqueville says, therefore, military readiness is always a struggle for democracy. Is this a perennial problem that we're facing today, or is there something new to the situation?
I don't think so, Jeff. You know, de Tocqueville writes very aptly about this, and one of my favorite scholars on the topic is the late Samuel P. Huntington. He wrote a book in 1957 called Soldier in the State, where he elucidated this exact tension that you note with de Tocqueville, that in a liberal society, small L liberal society like America of the 20th and now 21st century, the realities of a military based on an inherently conservative profession are in tension. You know, the politics and ideologies prevalent in Rights-Based Society of America are in tension with a military that must necessarily subjugate what is best for an individual in order for broader units to function. This is I think something people don't talk about enough anymore. And in many ways, people don't talk about enough, even as the tension has become more and more clear. Soon after Huntington wrote his book in 1957, the military flipped the script of its role in civil society. Robert McNamara, just after the passage of the Civil Rights Act, said that the military would be the first institution to adapt and fix the problems reflected by the crisis of civil rights of the 1960s, meaning that he didn't want a separation between military and civil society. He wanted the military to be at the forefront of societal and civil change, which in many ways means we're now at a unique crisis in what the collapse of this institutional tension can mean for democracy and for military readiness.
If we are as low in numbers as you say, and just sheer numbers in the Army, Navy, and Air Force, where are we in terms of readiness?
We're not ready. And part of it does have to do with numbers. There's what we call an operational training calendar in the Army. And so, you know, any unit, say in my case, the 75th Ranger Regiment, there is always one operational force that was deployed fighting the global war on terror. In our case, there was one operational unit that was training or preparing for an upcoming deployment. And then there was another operational unit that was on a, you know, more relaxed readiness cycle, leave, recovery, lower scale training in order to, you know, get that necessary time for recuperation and refit. When your numbers are so low, again, the end strength to which I referred, you lose the ability to maintain that consistent cycle, which builds in rest, recovery, and readiness as an inherent part of the Army's operational force posture. And again, the Pentagon tells the president and has told the president for the last 30 years or so that they can fight two wars against near-peer adversaries and one lower intensity conflict all at the same time. Think about that. And when you have the lowest end strength from, you know, since really the Vietnam War, you really wonder if that is simply a fantasy. And so it, you know, it affects our ability to allocate forces to different parts of the world. It affects our ability to genuinely manage different crises at once. And, you know, it oftentimes means that we rely on different formations like the National Guard or reserves or who are perhaps less equipped to deal with really complex, you know, tenuous situations. Frankly, we haven't faced the consequences, but, you know, we shouldn't let that be the reason why we don't understand the crisis at foot.
I think a lot of our listeners are thinking right now, as I am, all right, this does sound very serious. What are the causes of it? How did we get to where we are?
Well, let's go back to Huntington. Huntington himself, you know, charted, you know, really from the 17th century on, the manifestations were politics infused military decision making. You know, you had after the French Revolution, the replacement of military professional officers with loyalists in the senior officer ranks of the French military. And the result was three consecutive defeats at the hands of the Germans in 1871, World War I, and World War II. You know, what I think many agree was a collapse in French military readiness. And in many ways, the military still has not recovered to this day. That was because the filter for understanding who was qualified to serve in the military was based on political realities and political ideology as opposed to the military profession. I argue that we're seeing evidence of that same collapse in standards today. The military is seen as a force for political ideology As much as it is an institution that must have a strict and uniform adherence to military readiness. You know, I think that's dangerous. It is something that we must recognize. You know, when the military is seen as a place where, as the Army tells recruits, you can be all you can be, there is afoot, you know, an ulterior motive than just arming the force that is required to defend American interests. There's something, you know, I don't want to say it's sinister, but there's something distracting at play. And that's not what the military should be.
Interesting. What about other causes? So, for example, people will say when the economy is good, military recruiting goes down because there's alternative economic alternatives for folks, including and perhaps especially people looking for upward mobility.
Yeah, I don't buy that explanation. I mean, for the last 3 years, the economy has been so poor the past 3 years, and recruitment has not seen the uptick that you have otherwise seen in other points of the past, you know, 3 decades. So I think something more is afoot. You know, the Wall Street Journal reports that families of veterans are only 8% want their children or grandchildren to serve. And that's, you know, those are families that make up over 81% of, you know,
that's a shockingly low number. I mean, you hear all the time of sort of military families who father, grandfather served, a great grandfather served, a long military tradition. You're saying that's atrophying?
It is, because those families, I mean, the American Principles Project did surveys of these veterans. And the greatest reason, the most cited reason for this, I think, a collapse, as you know, Jeff, this collapse in confidence in the institution is a distrust of politicized military leaders. You know, when you have the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff who imposes racial quotas on the Air Force Officer Corps, when you have 3-star admirals in the Navy giving speeches at a Women's Equality Day event, urging military officers to be skeptical of laws passed by Congress because so many elected representatives are white men, I think you're seeing, you know, the chickens coming home to roost of this, you know, we're kind of running out our tab of, you know, this fidelity and trust in the military as an institution that started in World War II and has been very high, even through a lot of crises since, but perhaps is, like I said, running out.
What about the sentiment of younger people thinking about a career in the military, and maybe not so much as a career, but as a patriotic calling or duty? What is there any data or evidence on whether that's stronger or weaker now than in past decades?
I think it's weaker. And this, I rely more on anecdotal, personal attestation than, you know, hard research. But, you know, my generation, we joined during the war on terror, even though, you know, Iraq was contested as a political issue at home throughout, you know, when it started and throughout, you know, our war there, we still thought that there was some virtue and service that, you know, we could join and we could do something that was worthwhile to the American interest and to, you know, the friends and family whom we sought to defend. I think how the war in Afghanistan ended altered that paradigm for young people today. You know, 20 years of nation building collapsed over the course of a weekend. And it wasn't necessarily the fact that we withdrew. It was the fact that we were told, you know, success was just 10,000 soldiers away and, you know, just another fighting season away, when in reality, it was a house of cards for much longer than anyone wanted to admit. And it all collapsed over the course of a weekend. And you think of the blood, sweat, and treasure sacrificed for what was a futile cause. And, you know, you realize how disenchanted folks can be because they doubt that their military service would be spent in an effort genuinely connected to the American national interest.
It's interesting because that folks would have that perception. At the same time, it seems like in society, there continues to be post 9/11, a great respect, public respect at least, for military and military service. People will hear that someone is a service member and they'll say, thank you for your service. You know, you have military planes do flyovers of NFL games. I mean, it seems like there continues to be public respect for serving in the military. But what you're saying is that does not seem to be moving young people to join the military in numbers that they previously did.
Undeniably, that's true. And, you know, it's one thing to respect someone else for, you know, entering the breach, but it's a whole nother issue to do it yourself or to want your son or daughter to do it. And I can't really explain, you know, that dichotomy, frankly. I think the marketing is compelling and, you know, there are some valuable partnerships afoot. But you're right. I mean, there still is this kind of civic duty, this civic respect that is collective in nature towards military service. But, you know, when it comes down to decisions that affect someone's life, those are not being made at the same level as they once were.
What about pipelines into military service? I'm thinking of, I had friends when I was at university who were in ROTC, R-O-T-C, and other pipelines like that. What's the health or status of those kinds of pipelines, whether it's junior ROTC or ROTC at colleges or other paths into the military?
The pipelines into the military have been compromised by diversity, equity, and inclusion policy. You know, the West Point admissions policy is more radical than Harvard, right? Years of a Harvard admissions case that went all the way up to the Supreme Court. Years of discovery did not yield numerical quotas that dictated racial composition for each admissions class at Harvard. But West Point has been openly admitting to such policies since the 1960s. And this is where I think once again the bond between citizens and the military are being broken, because the military is making decisions about these key institutions like West Point and the Naval Academy, based on a political mandate to ensure that certain racial groups are represented, even though the standards applied may be different. And so this is, I think, where the trust breaks down. And, you know, on the surface, I don't know that there are. You know, differences in numbers that you can report for each, West Point class. But we know that retention is down. Army officers are leaving sooner than they have in the past. And we know, you know, enlistments in general are down. We know that admissions classes at the three services academies are having to work and spend a lot more money to get the same number of cadets and midshipmen in each class. And so I think these are telltale signs that there is something afoot, even though it's hiding under, frankly, a very bureaucratic and subversive public system of accountability for these institutions.
Before we continue with our conversation, I'd like to take a moment and ask you to learn a little more about the Ashbrook Center and how you can help us continue our work with teachers, students, and citizens.
I'm Chad Kiefer, Director of Philanthropy and Strategic Partnerships here at Ashbrook. At its heart, America's story is about the lives of patriots who have given their last full measure of devotion to preserve and protect what it means to be an American. But the tragic truth is that the American story is being rewritten as one of oppression and despair. Back in 1776, the founders took a chance when they created a new government built on principles of liberty. They took a chance on America. Now I'm challenging you to do the same. Your gift to Ashbrook today reaches students, teachers, and citizens across the country, helping them to understand why America is worthy of their devotion. With so many forces eroding our history and taking away from our principles, isn't it time we give America a chance? Your investment is encouraged now more than ever. Please visit us today at ashbrook.org/support.
What about inside the military itself? I remember one military historian saying that the strength of the American military and its fighting readiness was very often in the incredible strength of its junior officers, people who are commanding on the battlefield with great intelligence and courage and knowledge And just, he said, this was a British historian who said, it really sets the American military apart from other militaries around the world. What is the status of the readiness and capability of our junior officer corps?
You know, it's tough. I don't have statistical evidence or research that can point to, you know, this generation of junior officers being worse or less performative than a previous generation. I'm not offering that that contention necessarily. You know, but what I will say is this notion of qualification by inherent characteristic is something that is more relevant today than it has been. You know, just like West Point is deciding admissions classes based on the composition of skin color of people with different skin colors, so are, you know, different promotion classes. You know, you can get a degree in diversity inclusion studies as a West Point cadet. That same kind of ideology is taught at different intervals throughout your military career. What we know is that today there are more gates of accreditation and accomplishment that mirror civilian society than there were previous. You know, going to the Harvard Kennedy School is the same status of military promotion as it is, you know, civilian respect and potential. You know, we've kind of altered what it means to be a qualified military officer. And that's something I think especially conservatives have to reckon with, because if we're going to be serious about the status of the institutional integrity of the university system, we should be honest about what those systems have done to the military, because the military has sought to kind of connect the promotion gates and the gates of status to those same institutions we claim to be corrupted.
I'm also wondering, in terms of military readiness and maybe even strategic readiness, about speaking of sort of higher education, of the military's war colleges, whether it's naval war colleges, army, the various service branches. Do we have any evidence or any, do we know more about the situation at those places? Because they obviously have been a key for promoting strategic thinking and readiness among American military officers, particularly in the higher ranks.
You know, where, again, you know, statistical evidence is hard to come by, because there are almost no reporting standards, you know, for these institutions. Congress can ask for something. A congressman can ask for certain pieces of information, but there's no guarantee that they receive answers. You know, what I would point to is the track record of senior military leaders during the global war on terror. You know, it was no accident that our strategic plan in Afghanistan, you know, after, let's say, the first 6 months of activity after 9/11, was completely devoid of strategic perspective and realistic goals. You know, though each general in charge of Afghanistan came to Congress a few times a year and asked for a little bit more money and a few thousand more troops, trying to convince the American people that this would finally turn the tide in an effort of nation building in that country. You know, and it never worked, right? We saw how it never worked when the war ended. You know, but these generals were promoted time and time again for working up the same corporate-like promotion ladder with, I think, very little to show for their success. You know, there's the, you know, the internet meme that compares the number of ribbons on Dwight Eisenhower's chest on the eve of D-Day to the number of ribbons on Mark Milley's chest, you know, after a 40-year career of, you know, military mediocrity. And there's something there, I think. You know, we've inverted the you know, kind of the values, we've inverted the incentive structure of what it means to be successful. And it's a serious problem, because, again, one of the greatest reasons that so few veterans want their family members to serve is because they don't trust military leaders.
All right. Obviously, our listeners are maybe thinking what I'm thinking is, okay, what do we do about the situation? What are some possible reforms or constructive steps that we can take?
For this answer, I think simplicity is very key. On one hand, we have to stop the consideration of race and sex as characteristics for military personnel and programs. In 1948, President Truman signed an executive order that integrated the Army. It allowed blacks and whites to serve together in the same units. Genuine integration. What the Army did to implement that executive order is actually pretty stunning for 1948. They omitted race as a personnel category on Army personnel files. There was no race box to check. You didn't fill out your race. You know, nowadays you can't go into a kindergarten classroom without declaring your race. And, you know, President Truman's Army, though, until the 1960s, found a way to genuinely pursue equal opportunity. Let's have the political courage to return to that policy where race is genuinely not something that military officials can consider at all. It's not something they can measure or track even. The next thing I think would, you know, to your question, Jeff, would be consideration of how we select, analyze, and promote senior military officers. You know, our institute at Claremont did research on now over 600 generals and admirals who come up for promotion. And we've found that almost half of those generals and admirals up for consideration have made public political statements in support of diversity, equity, and inclusion policies. You know, and even four dozen of those officers have politicized their service to such a degree that they should not continue to serve and much less not continue to be promoted. You know, I mentioned the admiral who said that we should be skeptical of laws passed by Congress. Yeah, there's another, you know, now Army general who compared pro-life Americans to terrorists. You know, these are people who should have a higher standard of even private behavior if we are going to trust them to serve at such significant levels of the military in the intelligence community too. And so let's pay attention to who we're promoting. You know, this comes to Senate staffers. This comes to, you know, future Trump administration Pentagon. We need to seize the reins of a personnel process that we have turned over, you know, to the pure permanent bureaucracy of the Pentagon. It's time that that process is accountable to civilian officials, as military decision making should be.
Are there other ways to thinking about, is it a matter of getting more people into the military, or is it a matter of getting the right people into the military, even if the numbers are smaller? Or is it, do we need both? And if it's both, how do we get both?
Well, this is where I think grand strategy does come into play. You know, I think grand strategy can be overdone. You know, not everyone needs to have an opinion on, you know, the National Defense Review. But our grand strategy should reflect reality. You know, the reality is our military is not big enough or competent enough to fight more than one near-peer conflict at a time. And so we should adopt a grand strategy that prioritizes this truth. Or that acknowledges that truth and then prioritizes the conflicts that we could consider here, and let's start there. But we should seek a robust, strong, and if necessary, a big military. You know, one that is well fed, well trained, and ready to defend American interests. But I think it begins by defending American interests and reclaiming the trust of the American people that it's an institution that will spend precious blood and resources doing just that and not fighting, you know, forever wars with a tangential relationship with the military.
Some listeners are thinking, well, what about technology? Have advances in technology made it possible for the United States military to have fewer members, in some ways perhaps less ready to fight, because, for example, A drone operator in Nevada can use a drone anywhere around the world to do a lot of the combat, a lot of the fighting, apparently, that ground troops or special operations forces used to be able to do. Can technology solve some of this problem, or is that the wrong way to think about it?
So you bring up a good point, Jeff. Technology is critical. And my, you know, one of my criticisms of our Ukraine policy, you know, aside from the wisdom of us, you know, kind of stoking the flames of conflict and kind of emboldening the prospects of war, I think my criticism is that the U.S. is not interested enough in taking lessons, technology, and information from the battlefield in Ukraine and understanding how that should change our operational force structure, our tactical advancements, and our technological production. And so that would lead to two truths. One is that even in this modern age, there is no replacement for infantry seizing terrain and dominating physical space in time. That's still true. You can't replace that with robots or, you know, surveillance controlled by pilots in Nevada. But what affects getting there is much different. You know, drones have changed the nature of warfare, but it's not expensive drones flown from far away. It's drones that are cheap, readily accessible, that the lowest level tactical operator can employ efficiently and rapidly in order to affect the battlefield. You know, in Ukraine, you see $500 drones destroying $60 million tanks on both sides of the battlefield. You know, the imperative to, you know, get $200,000 missiles on the battlefield is almost irrelevant because there are cheaper, accessible, and more readily available alternatives that can redefine how people, how infantrymen move across battlefield space. So that's kind of the technological revolution we have to understand, while also knowing that it is a return to kind of the essential truth of war, that you can't replace a person owning a piece of terrain as a measure of victory.
Given what you've said and the steps that can be taken, how hopeful are you that we can resolve this crisis, or at least bring the American military back to a point of readiness in numbers and in strategic posture and in technology and just the right kind of people? How hopeful are you that we can correct the situation?
This conversation is happening on election day in the fall of 2024. So, you know, ask me tomorrow and I might have a different answer. I do think this is a salient issue. You know, President Trump has seized on it throughout his campaign. Democrats are deathly afraid to acknowledge the extent to which the military has become politicized. They know it's a bad issue for them. You know, I've testified in front of Congress before, and Democrats will spend entire questioning periods, you know, trying to obfuscate and pretend as if, you know, some of these realities are not such. And so on that sense, I do understand. But what, you know, what troubles me is how long we have to wait to figure out how bad things are. Do we have to wait for a true national security catastrophe to understand the crisis of readiness at which we find ourselves? Or can we get to a point where policies and people can be in place to fix it before something bad happens?
What about within the military itself? Are there voices saying, hey, look, we got to admit we have a recruiting and readiness problem that has to be dealt with? Are you seeing some of those voices speak publicly or privately about the situation?
You know, there are people who are always willing to say certain things privately. There's one voice who has made a brave change publicly. The Sergeant Major of the Army, Mike Werner, recently removed diversity guidelines for non-commissioned officer promotion guidance. He removed diversity as a consideration wholeheartedly and explicitly. And that's exciting. You know, that's a senior military leader with his job on the line wanting to make a change. And so you hope that kind of courage is contagious. But we need that to become systemic. We need that kind of courage to become systemic throughout the military. And we need them to have the political support in the Senate in particular to make that more sustained policy success real.
Well, fascinating and important and alarming topic, but I appreciate you taking the time to join us to shed some important light on it. Will Tebow, thank you for joining us on The American Idea.
Thanks so much for having me, Jeff.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The American Idea. If you enjoyed this episode, remember to subscribe at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave a 5-star review. If you want to learn more or get involved in Ashbrook's vital work, visit our website, ashbrook.org.